Either she homeless or she got problems. That's the only reason why she run to a black man.
I like him already.
Now you wanna get nuts? Come on!
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome...
Producer, director, writer. He is the ultimate filmmaker and bona fide foodie. You're listening to The Quiddituzz Factor with Michael J. Arbouet.
Hello, my friends. Thank you for joining me once more on this podcast. Greetings, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Quiddituzz Factor. I'm your host, Michael J. Arbouet. That Latin word, quiddituzz, what does it mean? Adriana, please give them the definition.
Quiddituzz, Latin, the whatness of a thing, the essential nature of something, the quality that makes a thing what it is.
Yes, quiddituzz is the whatness or essence of a thing or person. And in this episode, I want to talk to you about living your life with purpose or living your best life. You know, wisdom is a great source of power. It's through other stories and failures of success that we learn the most. And that's why I started this podcast, because listening to other people's stories, I want everyone out there to know that anything is possible if you put your mind to it. So there are three things you should do to start living your best life. And that first thing is, be confident in yourself. I can't emphasize this enough. Every one of us, including me, second guesses ourselves on whether we're doing something right or doing something wrong. Trust your gut instinct. If you think about it, really, really think about it, your gut instinct is always correct. It's always the one thing that if you had listened to it, it would have been the right thing to do. The second thing you should always be doing is looking forward. I am guilty of looking backwards and looking into my past and thinking about my past challenges or problems and wondering what I could have done to fix them. Guess what? It's too late. I can't fix them. It already happened. Always be looking forward. You need to look forward, and that's the only way to grow as a person. And finally, the third thing you should do to live your life with passion is to live a life of purpose. It's very, very easy to get stuck in a rut and just kind of be on autopilot. You know, if you work a 9-to-5, you go to work, you come home, you eat dinner, and then you need to relax and unwind. So you plop yourself down in front of the television, and next thing you know, it's time to go to sleep and do the whole thing all over again. And that is known as the, wait for it, rat race. Yes. So don't get stuck in that. You literally have to live a life of purpose. Think about the things that you really want to do and do them. I know it sounds crazy. I know it sounds ridiculous, but instead of wasting 8-9 hours, you know, playing video games or watching television, you know, read a book, do things that will make your life better. If you wanted to always learn how to play the guitar, there's so many things online that you can go on for free and learn to play the guitar. I mean, YouTube is a great resource to learn how to do anything. And never before, like now, in this time that we're living in, can we go online and find something to help us learn. It's 10 times easier than it was in the 80s or the 90s. And that reminds me of a quote by Lady Gaga. And that quote is, "You have to be unique and different and shine in your own way." Isn't that true? You have to be you. So, and that reminds me of my next guest. My next guest, of course, is an actor, a director, a producer, a father, and an all-out great guy. Without any further ado, let me introduce to you Blake Robbins. Blake, hey, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great.
Thank you for being a guest of my podcast. So as you know, the name of the show is called The Quiddituzz Factor, and quiddituzz means the whatness or essence of a thing or person. So I always like to start off with this first question. Like when you were 8 or 9 years old or like a teenager, did you know you wanted to be an actor? Was that the dream?
When I was 8 or 9 years old, my main plan was to just survive a day at school. I had no main plan. My family moved around an awful lot. So I felt like I was constantly the new kid. I certainly had no idea what I was going to do with my life. Probably somewhere around 11 or 12, I was pretty good at sports. So I had a delusion that I might play in the NBA or the Major League Baseball or something. But, you know, it was a delusion. But that's probably where I was about maybe 10, 11 or 12. Yeah. At nine, no, it was just like, what's for snack and how do I get through a day of school?
I definitely remember those days. I was not the most popular guy in school by any means. So let's fast forward a little bit and go into like high school, college. When did acting become the dream? When did you get into that?
Well, my parents always did it. My parents weren't professionals, but they always did it. They were actors, directors, and they would work in community theater. So I would always go see the shows that they were in. But again, all the way through high school, pretty much just trying not to flunk out of school, just, squeaking by with my C's, trying to not get in trouble for not doing my homework. And playing sports. I went to a junior college in Kansas, Southeast Kansas, Independence Community College, and my very first girlfriend in college wanted to be a broadcast journalist. And so in being in that side of things, she had to do some of the theater stuff. So she did plays, and she invited me to come to a play, and it was some weird adaptation of Winnie the Pooh, and I played a rabbit, and basically it was just to get closer to her. I mean, that was the first one, and I had gone there ostensibly to play basketball, but I was kind of already realizing that I was in over my head. It was a really great basketball school. I think they came in second in the nation for junior colleges my freshman year or sophomore year, one of those years, but they were always, they always won 25 games or so and were one of the best in the country. And so I didn't get much playing time. So I started messing around with the theater department just for lack of anything else to do. And I guess I was 1500 miles away from my parents. So it's not like they could judge me or criticize it or weigh in. So I found some personal freedom to go over there and see what they were doing. And I think in those 2 years of junior college, this would have been in the mid 80s, maybe early 83 to 85, 1983 to 85. I probably did about six or seven plays through their theater department, even though I wasn't in the department, but they would not turn me away when I showed up after that.
Wow. Yeah. So after college, when did you get actually bitten by the bug? Because you have a pretty impressive resume as far as acting is concerned. So when did you finally decide, yeah, this is what I want to do?
I was graduating from college. I finished my degree at Wichita State University, and I had a business marketing degree, and I had worked for a year or two for a lawyer and was thinking about going to law school. Was thinking about, working in politics a little bit, business a little bit, but nothing really excited me. And so, the way you think about you start to think about what am I going to do with my life as graduation from college approached. And about a month before I graduated from college with this business marketing degree, I thought, I think I'm going to try acting. I think I'm going to do this acting thing. My parents live north of Boston. I was like, I'll go back to the Boston area and I'll take some acting classes there. And I'll just get a job in a restaurant. And I worked in a restaurant while I was in college to pay some bills. So I was like, I'll just get a restaurant gig, bartending, waitering gig, and start taking some acting classes. And everyone I had gone to school with who is now, going into business or law or accounting or whatever, they were like, what? What are you doing? Where did that come from? I was like, I guess deep-seated, that's just those seven plays in junior college and just having seen it through my parents. And I don't know, it was an itch I felt like I had to scratch. So, and then on my 21st birthday, my parents took me to a traveling production in Boston the Broadway shows would come through Boston and play in the theater district down there. And they took me to a production of Les Mis, and I was blown away. And I remember, one, jealous that I couldn't sing and that singing wasn't a reality. But I was like, if I could do something that touched people even halfway or even remotely as close as to that, you know, theatrical endeavor touched my heart, I was like, that would be something I could get behind doing for the rest of my life. So it was about then. I just started taking acting classes in Boston and started auditioning for plays and started getting little plays here and there. And after a few years of doing that, I auditioned for the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in New York City. They were having their touring auditions where they come to Boston for 2 or 3 days and stay at a hotel and you just sign up and go in there, you know, one of us at a time for, we have our 10 minutes to do a couple of monologues and a little interview. And they were very kind to me, offered me some scholarship money and said, yeah, we'd be interested to see if you can make this work here at the American Academy. And yeah, so it took me about a year later that I started going to acting school in New York City.
So you make the move to New York City. Tell me about that big first acting job, whether it be in film or television. What was that one job for you?
I think Oz would have to be the difference maker. It was, first of all, it took me about 7 or 8 years out of acting school to get a break, to get a job. And that was, I got a couple of commercials here and there, and I did theater and acting classes nonstop. But the thing that changed my trajectory was that I got this audition for Oz, and somehow lightning struck and I got the job. And it went from being a couple episodes to being, you know, 2.5 seasons, about 14 episodes spread over those 2.5 seasons. And that's when I got representation. In fact, that's when I met your brother. He became my manager. I don't know if people know that about Michael, that his brother's in the business. It's probably come up in the podcast, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
That's when I met him with my first management company. And so, yeah, Kevin Arbaway became one of my managers, and I started to be able to get auditions on a more regular basis. That was probably that was about 2000. 2001. So it took a long, so when you think about it, I mean, I had to persevere when there was a lot of things pointing to the fact that I should stop, find something else to do with my life. Wow. When I got out of acting school in 90, I went there 92, 93 in New York. So it took a full six, seven full years.
Wow.
Toiling around New York City before I got Oz. But the fortunate thing is things quickly shifted into a much, that was when I was able to eventually quit my day job and kind of make a go at this, make a career out of it. And I can't say I haven't worried about the next job, because I think every actor that's not a series regular or a movie star has to worry about the next job. But I started to trust that I had what it took to make it as an actor, to get jobs, to whatever those shows were that you saw on IMDb that I booked, that I got, you know, I kind of at least had some confidence that I was going to work and work pretty steady.
Wow. So it's funny. I actually know a couple of people who were on Oz. I went to film school at Long Island University, and mm-hmm. I went to school with Ernie Hudson's sons. So yep. I know that Ernie Hudson was on the show, and his son, Ernie Hudson Jr., was on the show. Yep. And I went to school with him. And then I don't know if you know Sal Cercia. He was also an actor that was on Oz as well.
Not real close. Our storylines didn't intersect. There was a lot of cast, but I know the name. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know his work. There was a lot of great actors on that show.
Wow.
And a lot of people died on that show, a lot of characters.
Yeah.
So that kind of brings me up to my next question. You know, all the actors who I've had on this show have always asked me to ask other actors how they got their agent. So how hard was it to get your agent? And was that the breaking point that led to new jobs?
You know, you think it's a turning point, but my, you know, with the long lens view, looking back at it, there was all these micro turning points, all these tiny little things that led to one little thing, and one little thing led to another little thing. And that's the thing, in the moment, you don't see that stuff happening right before you. It was, for me, in retrospect, a career changer, but it wasn't one big thing. It was a bunch of tiny little things. I was able, once I got onto the show, Tom Fontana, who a wonderful gentleman who has another great show on City on the Hill, is his show that's out now, Homicide: Life on the Streets. You know, he worked on, I don't need to give Tom Fontana's resume. He's doing just fine by himself, but he's a great guy. And he and another gentleman who wrote the story arc for my character knew that I was looking for representation. And so they were kind enough to write me a little letter of introduction to use. And so I went around town trying to convince people that I was now on this HBO show. And I didn't really look like someone who should be on Oz. So so these episodes hadn't aired yet. And I think there was a little bit of a curiosity when people heard that I was maybe going to be on this show, that how does this guy fit into that show that I've seen for the last three seasons? So until the episode started airing, I didn't get much traction. But once the episodes came on and I was able to get some, you know, some footage of my work and cut that together and make one of those 8-track tapes back in the day and run around with that, and this letter from Tom Fontana and a couple of episodes on the tape and say, hey, I've made it. I'm a working actor. please give me a shot. It took a little while, but I finally got, you know, an agent and the management company. I was with LaSalle Management. That's where Kevin started working, your brother, and he started sending me out for things. And then a year or two later, I made a trip out to Los Angeles. I was just coming off now a more significant run of episodes of Oz, so I didn't have to defend being on the show anymore. People who knew the show knew who I was, and it wasn't, you know, luckily a significant part of our fan base was the industry. A lot of people were watching that show that were either casting directors or directors or other television people. You know, people were watching that show's pretty revolutionary at the time. You know, that and The Sopranos were the things to watch on Sunday night. So I got in a position where I didn't have to keep defending that I was going to be on this TV show and out there. And also at that time, I got a part in a Broadway production of a play that I was basically cast as the understudy, but I got to go on and do a couple of episodes. A couple of performances. So I had a Broadway credit, had these Oz episodes, and your brother Kevin actually suggested I head to LA for episodic season in the fall, and I booked a couple more jobs like within a month out here, and that's when I started making some relationships, getting a little traction. And by then I was probably in my mid-30s, but I was boyish looking, so I looked closer to 30 than 35. But that's pretty late in an actor's career to start making a living as an actor, in your mid 30s. Luckily I looked early 30s, but still 30s instead of 20s is, I had to play the long game.
Right. So are you in LA now, or you're in New York?
Yeah, no, I'm in LA. I've been in LA since Oz ran its course. I think Oz went off the air in 2001 or 2002, right about then. And I moved my family and my career to L.A., and I've been situated north of L.A. for about, we're going on, coming up on 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that was my around that time, I think that was my second run. I've tried to live in LA 3 times, and I found that I'm a diehard New Yorker. I couldn't hack it. Kevin's in LA now.
So, he is. Yeah, he comes back and forth. I mean, yeah.
He was going back and forth a little while. Yeah, he finally picked up his family and did the big move about 3 years ago. I moved there. We're probably around the same age, but I moved there in 1994 and didn't like it. Moved back by 1997, and I was getting more work in New York as a filmmaker than in LA. And then my brother had done like the Obama girl stuff.
Yep.
And we tried to do that move again. We'd had this deal working with a couple of different actors, but I just started a family, and I said, you know, we either have to go all in or not. And they weren't quite ready to go all in yet. They were being bi-coastal, so I decided to stay in New York. But that's basically my story. But what I find so interesting about your story is now you've been acting for a couple of years, and then you dip your toe into directing. And I want to talk about both of your films. I'm going to start with your first one, because, I mean, it's a heavy, heavy film, but the sublime and the beautiful. Tell me about how that came to be. I'm guessing that's your whole family that's in that movie, a very heavy topic. Tell me how you wrote it, and you just give me the whole journey.
Oh, okay. So, gosh, we're going back. We're in the Wayback Machine now. Well, first, I can tie it to Oz. I was fortunate when I got on Oz that I kind of, that the set environment was so inviting and everyone was so chill and cool that I got to hang around Video Village while all these great actors worked and all these writers and directors put the show together. So I just started watching. And this is my first job in television. And I didn't know enough to know that I probably shouldn't be watching, that I'm supposed to just go to my trailer and wait till I'm called and no one stopped me from watching. So I just developed this bad habit, and I put it in parentheses, bad habit, because maybe it was a good habit of just watching everyone work, you know, and just, and I share that to say that I kind of, from the very beginning, got this film school by observation thing going on, where I would just watch. Watch, observe, watch when the directors talk to the actors, watch when the actors figure it out, all that type of stuff. And I started doing that from Oz on, and it never left me. I got a little more sensitive to, on some sets, it was less appreciated than others. But if I was just minding my own business and walked away anytime I shouldn't be listening to a conversation, that I could kind of hang out and just learn and watch. And that's kind of the type of actor I became. So flash forward to early 2000s. I have this very personal story to tell that you talked about. It's heavy. It's heavy. Heavy subject matter. So it's got to be a small film. I went to college in Kansas, as I mentioned. So I just started playing with this idea that was part autobiographical, and that my dad's sister, my aunt, had been in a car accident, hit by a drunk driver, and some of the elements that our family went through together with that. And then this idea of, I was in New York City working as a bellman, working on Oz when 9/11 happened. And that was impactful for a lot of people. For me, one of the impacts is I just was left with this kind of story idea of a tragedy happening on an ordinary day. But instead of handling it on a huge level, like at the country, what if it happened? What if this tragedy happened to a family? An ordinary day is happening and this family experiences this tragedy. So I've got these couple of personal things in this story that's kind of just scratching at me, just saying, you know, tell me to the story. And simultaneously, as an artist, I'm having this feeling of, no one's going to let me play the lead in their movie. I haven't earned that right. I'm not the lead in anyone's movie. They're not auditioning me to play the lead in a movie. So I have this ambition inside to play the lead in a movie, and I'm starting to realize now, 10 years into my career, it's hard to get one scene in a movie, let alone the lead. And fortunately for me, the cost of movie making was coming down at that time. Like, all these digital cameras were coming out, all these cinematographers were getting, good at making movies with very little lighting equipment. You could start to think, oh, if I can scrape together, and then you got these sites online like, GoFundMe sites, Kickstarters, Indiegogos, they're just starting to happen where, your friends and family can help finance your dream if you can convince them that your dream is worth chasing and that they should, throw in some money to help you. And I was starting to think, and I'd been on enough sets though that I had stolen enough information where I was starting to think, oh, I could engineer this low budget film for about $30,000-$40,000, shoot it in a couple of weeks, use all my friends and family to, all the favors I can pull in, get my friends to act in it, get as many favors as I can, and I can play the lead in this movie. And by then I started thinking, I probably am the person to direct this movie. Mm-hmm. And that was something I had dreamed about. So I did. I just kind of threw my hat over the fence and said, next year, and this was in 2000, and gosh, I started writing it in 2003, 2004, when I got to LA. It gave me something to focus on. In fact, the first draft was on yellow legal pad. I just kind of hand wrote it all out. My wife looked at the yellow legal pad and said, all these characters have our names. She was like, I'm not that comfortable with our kids' names in the movie. And like you said, they ended up playing the kids and my name was Blake. So I had to create character names. I said, I'll do that later. I'll do that when I put it into the computer. And I just had a lot of good friends help. Matt Del Negro, who had been on The Sopranos, who also has a great podcast, 10,000 Knows, if anyone's interested in his podcast. He was just a buddy who was the one who encouraged me not only to keep writing and that there was something there, but that we could put it onto this software that I'd never heard of called Final Draft to make it look like a real movie. And I was like, oh, that's even better. You mean I can show it to people and it'll look like a movie on the page? And he was like, yeah. And he showed me how, and he spent some time with me showing me how to use Final Draft. And it's kind of self-teaching, it kind of helps people who don't know that much about screenplay format actually get there. I've read a lot of screenplays, so I know what they were supposed to look like. It was just a transition to be someone who could actually write screenplays that not only look like a screenplay, but deserve the time and energy that a good screenplay deserves. So I got that all together and kept working with friends, reading it out loud, improving it, scratching at it, getting close to getting the financing, not having it fall through. And then me saying, I'm just going to make it my own. I'm just going to make it myself. I'm going to raise some money on Kickstarter. And whatever I get, that's what I'll make the movie for. And the big, you talked before about the pivotal moment. The pivotal moment for that movie was, obviously, there was the micro moments of doing it, getting support, having all my friends support me in doing it and getting there and shooting it. But after we got it all edited and all the finishing touches on it to the best we could, it got into Slam Dance. It was one of the 10 films chosen in 2014. We shot it in 2012. Remember, I had been writing it since 2003. So it took a long time to get it done. And really, it kind of just took the moment of decision to go from, okay, I've got this script, to I'm going to shoot this next winter by one way or another. And we did it. We shot it in 12 days for $35,000, got it made. Once we had it online, once we had a digital copy, we submitted to film festivals and got turned down by a lot. And Slamdance responded to it. It was the kind of scrappy indie that they dug. And we went and played Slamdance, and that led to a film festival run. And that led to the film getting a distributor and actually being screened theatrically in a handful of places and being online. And I think you can still find it online out there if you want to. It moves around a little bit, but if you go to IMDb and look up the film, I think it's playing somewhere now. And that's rewarding, that a movie that, you know, came from nothing, that somehow I put together, you know, that chunk of change. And it led to me getting the next movie. So we can help transition to Casey Twinter and his writing partner, Jeff Robinson. They knew the film through the Kansas City Film Festival, and we struck up a relationship, and they asked me to take a look at their script for The Scent of Rain and Lightning. And we did that with significantly more money in 2017.
I was about to say that I was going to bring that film up. I mean, it looks so much more polished. Again, a very heavy film. I'm very impressed by the topic matters, because, you know, as an indie filmmaker myself, tackling heavy storylines is terrifying, because you don't want to mess it up. You don't want to look like an idiot, you know? So it's a very terrifying...
Wait, are you saying that I did look like an idiot? Or
No. I'm saying that...
I'm avoiding
looking like an idiot, yeah.
I'm going to put that on a poster. Blake Robbins, he avoided looking like an idiot.
You know, it's
I
like,
love it.
It's every filmmaker's nightmare, especially like, you know, you were talking about before raising money. I've tried to raise money on Kickstarter and GoFundMe, and, you know, it's like, you know, once you get like that one band of friends and everything, that, and all of a sudden it's like, you know, you kind of feel bad, because, you know, you're like, I still don't have enough money. Can you please?
You tap. Yeah. If you're like me, you tap everyone out really quick. Yeah. Everyone's like, you see you coming and they're like, dude, Blake, leave me alone. We already funded your career. If you haven't taken it from here, we can't help you.
But I was very, very impressed with both films and the way that they were made. And with the second film, because, you know, a lot of people who are listening are going to wonder how you got funding for that. Was that directly because of the work you'd done before that people felt more confident, or did you actually have financiers?
Financiers helped us with the second film. The second film was not a not a by any means possible self-funded thing. It was we had a legitimate budget. We had ended up with a crazy story that I don't know if I'm legally allowed to talk about, because half of our original financiers ended up in prison. Thankfully, they deserved it. But yeah, we ran into some crooks along the way, but somehow overcame their shenanigans and were able to scrape together $2 million. But, you know, when you make a film for $35,000 and then the next film you get paid more to direct it than you made your first film for, you're feeling like you're living large, you know, you're one of the blessed ones. I didn't write the script. I was a director for hire on that. It was because of the first film that relationship came about and that I was hired to direct it. And they gave me God bless them, they gave me a lot of creative freedom with the film, and we got a fantastic cast, you know, Micah Monroe, Will Patton, Maggie Grace. And now some of that was because of the first film. A lot of the cast that came to be in that film watched the first film, and that was part of the getting my foot in the door to have a conversation with them about doing this film. And it was financed by, you know, people who wanted to finance film festivals feature films and people that, you know, I would say believed in Casey and Jeff and myself. And, you know, we worked with the tax credit system and we shot it in Oklahoma you know, $2 million is a lot of money, but it goes really fast when you have, you know, when you're doing a union film and you have that many actors in that many locations and dealing with cattle and horses. And, you know, if you've seen the film, it's a much bigger film.
Yeah,
it's
whole new world. Now, I have to ask you.
One thing I learned, I was just realized this, but I'll never not realize it again as a filmmaker. How many cars were in my movie and how much money that cost? I was like, why are there so many cars? Why does every character have their own car? this is expensive. Why can't these people just show up? Why do they have to have a car?
Wow.
Or a truck? The stuff you don't realize going into it. I was like, yeah, I'm never going to allow a film with like 12 cars again. For every character, there's a new car.
That's so funny. That was my next question. Was it a scarier feeling dealing with a bigger budget and having that much responsibility?
Michael, I'm going to be honest. They're all scary for different reasons. Do you know what I mean? I think most fear is internal. You know, it's not like I'm going to get any more scared personally. I deal with my own demons. I deal with my own imposter syndrome. I deal with my own anxiety disorder. I deal with my own. And one thing I take comfort in is anytime I've met someone who doesn't deal with any demons and thinks they're all that and a bag of chips, they usually have very little talent and very little ability. Anytime I meet someone who's like appropriately terrified and willing to just own that and then move forward, they generally have some talent, some ability, some recognition of the size of the creative endeavor they're about to undertake. So I'm terrified and I do it anyway. I think Princess Leia said that. Carrie Fisher, I think, said, own your fear, own your terror, and just do it anyway. Wow. So, yeah, I was terrified, you know, to give direction to Will Patton and stuff. You know, I was like, what have I got to say to Will Patton that he hasn't already heard? Why should I say anything to him? But as it would be, I ended up having things to say. I can't help but watch and feel like I can offer an actor something that will help the project, the moment, the thing. And so I just take a deep breath, you know, but that is one of the things I find that directors do shy away from celebrities in terms of giving them direction. And I found out on The Scent of Rain and Lightning that, I've got something to offer anyone who starts acting, you know, and the really good ones want that. They want to collaborate. They want to hear, they want the information. I mean, it's teamwork. They don't want to just be left to their own devices entirely, but generally they are, because most directors are as afraid as I am, but don't do anything about it.
Well, you know, the one thing that I would have to say as a person who started out as a director and then dabbled in acting, you know, as an actor, you know how other actors think, you know how other actors, you know, what they deal with. So, you know, when an actor turned director, I feel you have a better understanding of how to direct an actor.
I do know the vocabulary, and I would say that every film, both of them, both my films, I did everything I could to put the actor in the best possible position to work. And I did that based on my own experiences of what I prefer, you know what I mean? And how I prefer to work. And also recognizing that every actor is slightly different. The other day I made the analogy that if you go to the Kentucky Derby, and you don't have to be a horse racing fan to understand this analogy, I think, but there's 20 horses that are going to run that race, and none of them are the same. They're all slightly different. They're going to get into the gait differently. They're going to behave before the race differently. They're going to run the race differently, but they're all trying to run the race to the best of their ability. That's kind of like working on a movie with 20 actors. They've got pretty much the same thing. They've got to get into the gate. When the bell rings and the gate opens, they've got to run, but everyone likes to do it slightly different, and you can't treat them all like they're the same. It looks very similar, but everyone's slightly a little, you know, a little bit different, a little wired a little differently, likes to run a little differently, likes to prepare a little differently, likes to get ready a little differently. And I think being an actor's director, being an actor, that is one of my skill sets that I can bring to directing a movie, which is I recognize that and just observe and appreciate it and still work with, you know, I think I accidentally just compared all actors to horses and I apologize for that, but that, yeah, I'll still stand by the metaphor. Everyone likes to do it a little bit differently.
Wow. So before I get into my crazy and zany podcast questions, I have to ask,
please,
what is your, what is one of your favorite roles that you've had as an actor?
Oh, I think a couple jump right out. Oz, for obvious reasons, it was the first time I felt like I had been invited to the team and everyone was so beautiful, such good acting around me and such talented people. And I just felt like, you know, after wandering around looking for a family for 8 years in this business, that I had found a little bit of a family, and it couldn't have been a more beautiful first family. So almost everyone I know and that I still stay in touch with on Oz is so grateful for having worked on that show. And I am as well. And it was the game changer for me. It was the start of me being able to have a career. So that stands out. The Office. Mm-hmm. I played Jim's brother, Tom. I think I ended up in about five episodes, maybe four. I might be exaggerating if I say five, but the wedding episode was a double episode, the introduction of our characters, and then I got to come back for a small scene in another one. That was so good because I was a huge fan of that show. And I don't think I'm telling any secrets when I say, you don't always want to meet your idols. They sometimes turn out to be quite disappointing. So to go on a show where I was such a huge fan and to find out that everyone was really, really cool, mm-hmm, and worthy of those fond feelings and also so talented, again, another incredibly collaborative. There's a reason that show worked and worked as well as it did. And it was because those people were as much fun to be around as they were to watch on TV. So that was fun and exciting. And I just remember feeling like, oh, I'm living a fan's dream. I've been cast, and it could have turned into a nightmare. It could have not lived up to expectations. And just the opposite happened. It exceeded expectations. All those actors, pretty much as cool as you would hope they would be being a fan of the show. And I just saw how much personal freedom they gave themselves to construct the comedy. So I felt again like I learned a lot, just like, oh, I could be this adventurous too. And so I started making, you know, adding a few ad libs, you know, and it's funny because you get the side eye from like someone who's done 200 episodes, like, oh, you're going to go with that? You're going to just throw that in? That's not even in the script. What are you doing? All right, new guy. Watch out. You know, you're not Steve Carell. Don't forget. But that was another great one. And obviously The Sublime and Beautiful, because it was me getting to be the movie star in my own movie. And I created it and got to star in it and got to make it my own thing. And there was a lot of satisfaction in that. So I think those three stand out as highlights for me. There were some other great moments, but yeah, those three are probably that's probably my Mount Rushmore. I need one more to go on the Mount Rushmore. I'll leave a space.
Okay. Wow. So now I'm going to ask you some of my patented questions that I ask a lot of my different guests. I'm so curious to hear the different answers. So one of my first question to you is, what's the one thing that acting did for you that you didn't expect?
Made me a better human being, made me more empathetic, made me connect more to humanity and become more understanding. I think when I was young, I didn't recognize the personal growth that 20, 25 years of playing all these different characters would give me. I think, you know, I was young. I was naive. I was just, you know, thinking of more immediate things like, oh, maybe I'll be famous or maybe I'll be, but, you know, but the real winning combination was the personal growth that put me through.
Tell me, what's something people seem to misunderstand about you?
I don't know. What do they misunderstand about me? If I'm being honest, you know, I was having this conversation the other day. I was driving my daughter, who's a sophomore in college, back to college, and we were talking, and I love these drives because it's 5 hours on the road and it's just she and I, and we listen to music and we talk art. She's getting into the business. And I said, you know, I've come to believe that even if you're like, we were talking about social media and how people misrepresent themselves, you know, they kind of put their best foot forward and how people are saying, oh, I want you to focus on the image of me, not the reality, the authenticity of me. We were talking about how all these things that I didn't have to grow up worrying about. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And she's 20 years old. So she's lived half her life or in her entire adult life with this idea that there's this representation you put online, you put out in the world and say, this is me.
Right.
And we were talking about whether that's real or not. And I said, you know, I've come to believe that no matter how you want to misrepresent yourself, that's you. Like in a twisted way, like even if it's not quote unquote authentic, and someone would say, oh, that person's disingenuous, or we would find out they're not who we think they are. I think, you know, that's, I've just, my 55 years on the planet, I just say people are who they are. And even in their misrepresentation, even if even my mask is some sort of reality, it's some sort of, you know, whatever it is I'm protecting or hiding or covering, like, you know, like say when a famous, I don't want to get too far into it, but OJ Simpson became who OJ Simpson was. He was always that guy, you know, whether you believe, you know, he committed the crime or didn't. Like he was also the guy on Airplane, the movies. He was also the football star and the guy, but he was this other thing that we all possibly didn't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's an extreme example, but I say, you know, the truth will come out. We'll know who you are eventually.
Right.
You know, Robert Blake, Phil Spector, you know, it time and time again, or, you know, even thank God, that Derek Chauvin was found guilty, but he was always Derek Chauvin. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? He just finally got caught on tape being who he was, and it was against the law. And thank God that justice prevailed. But he may not have been a murderer until that point, but he was always the guy capable of doing that, who did that, who smiled at the camera and thought he was going to get away with that.
Right. Wow.
So I don't know. So I don't know that people misperceive me at all. Whatever they get, whatever they see, whatever they think, whether I like it or not, is probably there's some truth to it.
Here's a question for you. Tell me about somebody who touched your heart and how they changed your life for the better.
Been very lucky to have a handful of these people. I would put my kids at the top of the list. They have just cracked my heart open so wide and made me so so much more attentive to who I am and the world I want to be in and how I want to impact that world. And yeah, so I put Cooper, Molly, and Emma, my three kids, high on that list. Just last week, I was asked to do a seminar for the Kansas City Film Festival because someone that we all loved who were familiar with that festival, Drew Burbridge, passed away, and they wanted to do a seminar honoring him, and they asked me to do it, and it was very humbling. He was just a knight, a prince of a guy. He was someone who always made the situation or the people he interacted with better for it. And we were kind of like oil and vinegar, because I'm a little more guarded and a little more jaded, and I normally try to protect my time, and he was just so open and available. And his approach to life, he did the BTS, the behind the scenes for The Scent of Rain and Lightning, and made this beautiful love story of a 25-minute film about our movie. And he made a connection with Justin Chatwin, one of the actors, and together they made a documentary. They drove to the southern tip of Argentina. They got on these motorcycles and drove the entire continent of South America. They may have even kept going in North America. I don't know. But the fact, that's adventurous. That's being available to the opportunities. That's making a friend and saying, hell yeah, let's go for it. Let's live life the way it's meant to be lived. Let's just go on an adventure. He passed away at 35, but his spirit left an indelible mark on me. And I know everyone who knew him knows what I'm talking about.
If you could turn back time and talk to your 18-year-old self, what would you tell him?
Do not wear your hair like that, dude. That is a bad look. But that's probably not going to help me that much, but it is true. What would I tell my 18-year-old self? It's going to be all right. You're going to be all right. Just relax. But you know, I'm not one of those one that's big on changing what happened. I can't say it was a near death experience, but I did have a widowmaker heart attack back in November. All right. So you do have a moment where you lay there before I get the stent put in, where you have those 3 hours before they go in and just make sure that artery gets unclogged, where you get the gift, the brilliance, as it turned out for me, because I survived it and I'm totally fine and I can, you know, work with this. But you get the beauty of those 3 hours where you get to think, would I do anything different? Am I okay with all this? If this was it. And I felt blessed to think I'm okay with it. You know, I lived on my terms and I did the best I could, and I'm content. And then I got the double blessing of, I came out of the surgery, I'm totally fine. And I can take preventative steps to make sure I don't end up back there too soon. By the way, if you're experiencing sharp pain in your back or your chest or your side, go get it checked out. Wow. You don't want to be like DMX. You want to be like me and get it checked out. You don't want to grin and bear it. It's better to, it's a simple thing in the ER, and I know it costs some money, but it's a simple thing for them to give you this test to check if you have this enzyme coursing through your body, which tells you, yes, indeed, you're having a cardiac event, which is their medically correct way of saying you're having a heart attack. They kept coming in saying you're having a cardiac event. And I was like, when did we start calling it a heart attack? Is that what you mean? They were like, yeah, we can call it a heart attack. We have to say cardiac event. But I'm just going to tell you, you can go in there and they can check to see if this enzyme is racing through your body. And that's how they know. So please, if I can save anyone out there who listens to this, if you're having a sharp pain or anything that feels really off, because if I hadn't gone that day, you know, I wouldn't be here. But I am here, and I am here with the knowledge that I would only tell my 18-year-old self, it's all going to be okay. Not much more than that, because you know what? There's a beauty in the unknown. There's a beauty in the discovery. There's the beauty in just going with figuring it out.
I mentioned this earlier in the podcast. As you and the audience knows, quiditas means the whatness or essence of a thing or person. But to make it easy, let's just say that quiditas means magic power or superpower. What would your magic power or superpower be? What is your quiditas?
I think it's my ability to recognize that in others. That which you just described. I've not used that word. You say quiditas?
Quiditas, yes, a Latin word.
Quiditas. Quiditas. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love now knowing that and that word. I think my gift and superpower is searching and being open and I think that's what I do as a director of films, as a writer of films, as an actor, is I look to others and say, what is it about you that's your quiditas? What's your gift? And celebrating it, you know, in a collaboration, if I'm directing them in a movie or if I'm just helping them anyway. But I think, yeah, I'll give myself a pat on the back for that. I'm always looking for that same thing in others that you just described, that you search for in us, those of us that are lucky enough to be guests on your podcast.
Thank you so much for saying that about me in the show. You know, you've given such great advice to everyone out there who is an actor, but what's one thing you'd like to debunk about being an actor right now?
That it's going to make you a lot of money. I don't know if that's a common myth. I think people are over that one. Common myth about being an actor. That all right, so my daughter wants to get into this, and she's really talented, and she's got a nice leg up because, you know, she's seen me do it, and we've had these conversations, and I try my best to share information with her, but I always preface it with this, and this is what I want to preface for all the young actors out there, and in the spirit of my daughter, Molly, who's starting this journey, she's in her first year of kind of doing this, and she's booked a couple of films, and she's just at the very beginning, and I always tell her, don't believe everything you hear just because you hear it from a source you trust. Learn to trust your own intuition. Believe what you need to believe, because your journey is going to be as unique to you. There's going to be overlap. There's things that are similar, but not even from your own dad, who you know has your best interest and loves you and is only thinking about. It's still. Everything I share is littered with my own experience, and don't take it from me just because I say it. I guess I'm talking about is, the Greek word or Latin word? Don't live with the results of other, the definition, I can't even think of the word right now, I'm drawing a blank from old age or something. Don't live with the results of other people's thinking. Live with the results of your own thinking. Because even if it comes from a loving, supportive, caring place, it is tainted. It's tainted by my experience. Have your own experience. Right. Find your own truth. Trust your own intuition. And I see too many times actors, either with acting teachers, acting classes, you know, there becomes a cult-like phenomenon around it, or, you know, an acting guru. Take everything, challenge everything with a grain of salt. Don't, you know, everyone's truth is going to be unique to them. So that's what I share.
Blake, thank you so much for sharing that with me and the audience, because that's so true. Live your own truth, because what I believe is completely different from what someone else believes. And even if they have your best interest in heart, you know, they may be wrong, you know, so you really have to learn from your own experiences. So my final question of the day is, what does the future hold for Blake Robbins?
I think after this podcast, I'm going to go get a bowl of Total cereal. That sounds healthy, because I had a pretty unhealthy breakfast and or lunch, early lunch. And honestly, beyond that bowl of Total, I don't want to, you know, I live in my own set of, I always have irons in the fire, and I'm always working on something. And I think that's really important. I think it's really important to always have something that you control creatively. Otherwise, you're at the mercy of this industry completely. Like, I'm always writing a script, something I love, and I'm always following my passion, and things will come to me, like little gifts. Like I didn't know The Office was going to happen until I was walking my dogs in the dog park, and I was told, hey, you need to run over to Allison Jones' office and get these sides and do that. And then a week later, I was on The Office, and that came totally out of the blue. And that's amazing and wonderful. But if you're living, waiting for those moments as an actor or as a writer or as a director, or even just life, even if your job is painting the outside of houses, I just picked that from anything. It can be any job. If you're living for permission from someone else to do something, or permission or things that aren't within your control creatively or life, the best way to do that is to make sure you've always given yourself something to focus on that no one can take, have, you know, it's yours. Like for me, it started when I started working on The Sublime and Beautiful, and it tortured me. There was ups and downs, good times, bad times, but I would never change it. It taught me a huge, huge thing, which is always have something that's mine that no one can tell me what to do, tell me how to do it, and I think if you're in this business, that's what I would say, get really good at always having something for yourself that no one else can, you know, then you'll get these little gifts that come out of the blue and everything. But you've always got some part of your creative imagination, your brain, your creation. You're always working. Does that kind of make sense? You understand, because you're in the business what I'm talking about. Yeah. Because the people that are tortured are the people that always need someone else to say yes, always need someone else to give them something, always need. I mean, I did it. I did it for 20 years. So I know what that's like too. And I wasn't a writer. I wasn't a director. I wasn't a filmmaker. I didn't go to film school. I just decided I was going to start giving myself something so that I always had something to work on that no one could take away.
Yeah, that's great. Because, you know, if you didn't do it, you'd still be waiting. You know, that's,
I would.
That's the magic. Yeah, the you magic never know. Yeah.
you never know.
Blake, thank you so much for being on the show. That was absolutely fantastic and some great, great advice for those working in the industry. And even if you're not working in the industry, this advice is just killer. It's a golden nugget. You can find Blake Robbins on Instagram, Facebook. Blake, can you take us out?
Hey, this is Blake Robbins, and you're listening to the Quiditas Factor.
Thank you for listening to The Quiditas Factor. I'm your host, Michael J. Arbouet. Before I let you go, please check out my website at www.mikearbouet.com. That's MikeArbouet.com. And you can check out my shop. There you'll see a shop called Arbo Artifacts, where I have some t-shirts for sale that will help the show, as well as my wife's Etsy store, which is called Poem Jewelry Design. And Poem actually stands for Power of Each Moment. So please check out that store, because she sells a lot more than jewelry there, and it's really cool and amazing. And I'm not just saying that because I'm her husband. I'm saying it because it's true. And finally, if you can, please become a patron. Thank you for the people who are patrons so far, like Dr. James O'Brien and Ed Burns. Thank you so much, and I hope to see everyone join if they can. And please join me every Tuesday for a new episode of The Quiditas Factor. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
Thanks so much for listening to The Quiditas Factor with Michael J. Arbouet. We'll catch you next time.